Welcome to the sixth Ernest Gellner Nationalism Lecture, organized by the Public Lectures Office on behalf of Nations and Nationalism and under the auspices of the Association for the Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism. This is the fifth of the series dedicated to commemorating and perpetuating the signal legacy of my teacher, Ernest Gellner, to the study of nationalism. Among Ernest's many intellectual interests and scholarly achievements, the theory of nationalism occupied a special place. He was justly proud of having formulated an overall theory of so complex and protean a phenomenon, and one so central to the modern world. He returned again and again to the subject, from his first version of the theory in Thought and Change in 1964, through his main statement of it in Nations and Nationalism in 1983, right up to his last posthumously published contribution in Nationalism. This, besides many articles and essays, and the founding in his last years of an institute in Prague devoted to the study of nationalism. It is for these reasons that we in ASEN and in Nations and Nationalism are so pleased to be able to honor Ernest Gellner and to reflect on his seminal and path-breaking contributions. And we're very glad to be able to have with us today a very distinguished scholar who not only knew Ernest well, but is particularly well equipped to test and apply Ernest's theory as a result of his own thorough study and excellent analyses of Ernest Gellner's theory of nationalism. So I'd like today to welcome my friend, Brendan O'Leary, and first things first, to congratulate him warmly from all of us on the birth just now of his daughter. Our very best wishes to you and your family. Brendan was born in Cork, Ireland, grew up in Nigeria, Northern Ireland and the Sudan, was educated in Ireland at Oxford and at LSE, where he is now a professor of political science and head of the Department of Government. He is the author, co-author and editor of 11 books, including The Politics of Ethnic Conflict Regulation and Explaining Northern Ireland, and of numerous articles in learned journals, books, magazines and newspapers. Recently, he published with John McGarry a book entitled Policing Northern Ireland, A Fresh Start, which is said to have had a significant impact on the deliberations of the Patten Commission. His fields of research and expertise include nationalism and national self-determination, national and ethnic conflict regulation, electoral systems, federal and devolutionary governments, and theories of the state. For 10 years now, he's been a political and constitutional consultant to Irish, British, and American politicians and public officials working on the Irish peace process, and he's worked for the Department of International Development, European Union, and the UN on conflict regulation initiatives in Somalia and South Africa. He's also been a political advisor to Dr. Marjorie Molam and Kevin McNamara. Among other things, he is, as you probably will know well, a regular broadcaster on British, Irish, and American networks, and recently he hosted and interviewed many people on a program on nationalism and conflict on analysis on Radio 4. He's currently co-authoring an intellectual biography of the late Ernest Gellner, so he combines both knowledge of Ernest's contribution and his own seminal and very interesting contributions on ethnic conflict and nationalism. Can I introduce Professor O'Leary? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Anthony, for that generous introduction. I'm delighted to join you in fatherhood, as in many other activities that we have in common. It was a signal honor to be asked to give the fifth Ernest Gellner Memorial Lecture. I was with Ernest Gellner in Budapest in 1995 on the night before he died, attending a conference that he had organized at the Central European University on the theme of formerly dominant ethnic minorities. My task was to address the position of the Anglo-Irish in sovereign Ireland. On the road between the conference location and a restaurant, he taxed me with a riddle. What is the historic difference between Ireland and the Czech lands? Since I did not know the answer, he told me, in the Czech lands, the other side won the Battle of the Boyne. a very typical example of Ernest Gellner's repartee and a memorable parting shot. I cannot, however, unlike what Anthony said, claim to have known Ernest Gellner well as a person, though I did have the privilege of having my doctoral thesis on the Asiatic mode of production examined by him. He began the Viva by warmly congratulating me, telling me that he was recommending it for publication, that he'd arranged a publisher, and suggested that he would write a foreword if that had my consent. Naturally, I felt totally elated. But then he counseled me that he had one minor obligation to perform. He was required, in the manner of Karl Popper, to test whether he could falsify the thesis that I had written the dissertation. A chill ran down my recently elated spine. He then performed his duty, corrected all of my errors, and gave me salutary advice on matters philosophical, anthropological, linguistic, historical, and sociological. Lastly, he presented me with 20 pages of typed commentary, amounting to an article in response to my efforts. In short, he demonstrated generosity, utterly professional social scientific standards, and astounding scholarly range. I relate this story not merely to recall my own moment of glory at the hands of a master, but to emphasize that Ernest Gellner was a true polymath. His writings on nationalism are just one component, albeit significant, of his rejuvenation of liberal social theory and philosophy. He was a major philosopher. He was the executioner of local Anglo-Saxon linguistic philosophy, and indeed the best diagnostician of our cognitive predicament in a world made clearer but colder by positivism. He was an exemplary anthropologist, both theoretically and in the field. Saints of the Atlas remains an absolutely indispensable reference for those interested in segmentary lineage systems. He was a novel philosopher of history who purged historical materialism of its teleology and eschatology, but extracted a useful kernel from the debris. He was also a liberal pluralist who revived important intellectual work on the distinctiveness and merits of civil society in explaining European uniqueness. Last but not least, he was a mordant and relentless critic of relativism and intellectual pretension in whatever guise it might manifest itself, psychoanalysis, Parisian Marxism, sweetly theological Hegelianism, or of what he called postmodernist meta-twaddle. In commemorating his fellow poet W.B. Yeats, W.H. Auden wrote that the words of a dead man are modified in the guts of the living. In commemorating Ernest Gellner in this series, we must not forget the full gamut of his intellectual accomplishments, and we should recall that his thinking on nationalism had a place within his broader liberal philosophy. But in respecting this work and Ernest Gellner's values, we must, especially where evidence and logic demand it, self-consciously correct, modify, and improve upon his thought. He would not have had it otherwise. Which brings me to the subject of tonight's lecture, the relationships between federalism and nationalism. There is a standard criticism of Ernest Gellner's theory of nationalism. Here is one particular author's attempt to summarize it. Gellner appeared to assume that the range of possibilities in modern times is bifurcated. There is a simple choice between nationalist homogenization through assimilation and nationalist secessionism, which produces another nationalist homogenization. But modern political entities have developed strategies that prima facie counteract the potency of nationalist politics. Systems of control, arbitration, federation, autonomy, and consociation. The last three of these are compatible with liberal and egalitarian pluralist principles. Throughout the modern world, these methods have existed at various times and in many parts of the world, and new versions of them are continually springing into being. The persistence of such strategies and regimes based upon them are empirical embarrassments for Gellner's theory. The equilibrium condition of one nation, one state, seems to be continually elusive. I was the author of the words just quoted, but my position was not unusual. Professor Alfred Stepan expressed very similar sentiments in the same volume in which my chapter appeared, namely The State of the Nation, Ernest Gellner and the Theory of Nationalism, edited by John Hall. Stepan's chapter is entitled Modern Multinational Democracies, Transcending a Gellnerian Oxymoron. Al Stepan and I are political scientists by trade. We have absolutely no quarrel with the evidence in favor of Gellner's theory. In the last two centuries, the bleak testimony of genocides, ethnic expulsions, partitions, coercive assimilation, secessions, and territorial restructurings upon the collapse of various empires have all tempered the optimism of everybody but the most fanatical exponent of human progress. But in essence, Stepan and I, representing political scientists, had two responses to Gellner's work. The first was empirical. The evidence of the persistence of liberal, polycultural, and multinational democratic states, federal or consociational in format, suggests blatant disconfirmation of Gellner's theory. The second was normative. We did not want to accept the fundamental sociological limitations on constitutional statecraft that his theory implied. There can be no doubt, however, that Gellner held the views that we ascribe to him. Here are four samples from three of his books. I quote, first of all, "Nowadays, people can only live in units defined by a shared culture and internally mobile and fluid. Genuine cultural pluralism ceases to be viable under current conditions." A second quote, "The new imperative of cultural homogeneity is the very essence of nationalism. For the first time in world history, a high culture becomes the pervasive and operational culture of an entire society. The state has not merely the monopoly of legitimate violence, but also of the accreditation of educational qualification. So the marriage of state and culture takes place, and we find ourselves in the age of nationalism." Quote three, "At the beginning of the social transformation which brought about the new state of affairs, the world was full of political units of all sizes, often overlapping, and often with cultural nuances. Under the new social regime, this became increasingly uncomfortable. Men then had two options if they were to diminish their discomfort. They could change their own culture, or they could change the nature of the political unit, either by changing its boundaries or by changing its cultural identifications." And lastly, "In our age, many political systems which combine cultural pluralism with a persisting inequality between cultures are doomed, in virtue of their violation of the nationalist principle, which in past ages could be violated with impunity. Gellner, of course, emphasized that nationalism is the primary principle of political legitimacy in the modern world. He didn't say it was the only one, nor did he imply that it was irresistible. Nevertheless, his readers were left in no doubt of the potency of nationalism. He clearly, however, wished that it could have been otherwise. In his last writings, he made it absolutely clear that he was very disappointed by the breakup of the Soviet Union, by the breakup of Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia. He entertained hopes that advanced industrial societies might diminish national conflicts, that emerging global imperatives might prompt a new division of political competencies, with supranational world government to manage technological, ecological, and terrorist threats in conjunction with the cantonization of local and educational functions. And lastly, that the defetishization of land with the disappearance of peasantries might be a possibility. In brief, Ernest Gellner was not against federalism or other forms of polycultural and multinational or indeed post-national government. If anything, he was strongly in favor of them. He was just skeptical about their prospects and their robustness. The arguments made by Alfred Stepan and myself against Gellner may, however, have been incorrect or at least premature. I want to argue that Gellner's implicit theses about the limited prospects for the reconciliation of nationalism and federalism were even more powerful and more consistent with the evidence than they seemed, though he himself may not have done the research to demonstrate this. What follows in tonight's lecture will therefore extend Gellner's theory in a manner consistent with his own propositions, if not with his own actual words. If my arguments are persuasive, then the criticisms that I have leveled against Gellner need to be rejected, or indeed severely qualified. But they also suggest that there is more room for constitutional engineering than Gellner seemed to believe. If the full array of arguments that I make tonight are therefore persuasive, then both the master's ghost and his pupil should be pretty content, entirely appropriate, I think, for a memorial lecture. So to explain what I'm going to say, I need to give you the definitions of federalism, federal political systems and federation, and indeed of nationalism that I intend to deploy, together with a brief resume of how the relationships between nationalism and federalism have been characterized in the last two centuries. Then I shall elaborate and explain a theory of why stable democratic federations appear to require a Staatsvolk, a dominant people. Having done that, I present evidence in favor of the theory, And then I'll point out some difficulties. These difficulties will then be explained, or if you prefer, explained away. And lastly, I'll turn my attention to the political implications of the arguments that I've made. To begin with, definitions. Federalism is a normative political philosophy, a political philosophy that recommends the use of federal principles, that is to say, combining joint action with self-government. Federal political systems, by contrast, is a descriptive catch-all term for a range of political organizations that combine both shared rule and self-rule. Federal political systems, thus broadly construed, include federations, confederations, unions, federacies, associated states, condominiums, leagues, and indeed cross-border functional authorities. Federations, by contrast, and it's with these I shall be largely concerned tonight, are very distinct federal political systems, and they're best understood in their authentic, that is to say, democratic and representative forms. In a genuinely democratic federation, there is a compound sovereign state in which at least two governmental units enjoy specific constitutionally separate competencies, although, of course, there may be concurrent powers. Both the federal and the regional governments are each empowered directly to deal with the citizenry, and the relevant citizens directly elect at least some components of the federal and regional governments. In a federation, the federal government usually cannot unilaterally alter the horizontal division of powers. Constitutional change normally requires the consent of both levels of government. Therefore, a federation automatically implies a constitution and normally is accompanied at the federal level by a Supreme Court charged with umpiring disagreements between the governmental tiers. Federations also have bicameral legislatures in which the federal, as opposed to the popular chamber, may disproportionately represent, that is to say, overrepresent, the smallest regions. Daniel Elazar additionally emphasizes the covenantal nature of federations. That is to say, the authority of each government is derived from the constitution rather than from another government. So having defined the F words, let me turn my attention to nationalism. Nationalism, by contrast, is a political philosophy which holds that the nation should be collectively and freely institutionally expressed and ruled by its co-nationals. This definition is very similar to Ernest Gellner's, who held that nationalism is primarily a political principle which holds that the political and the national unit should be congruent. Observe that nothing in either definition makes nationalism automatically incompatible with federalism or federal political systems or federation. Collective and free institutional expression of more than one nation may in principle be possible within a federation. The federation indeed may be organized to make the regional political units and the national units congruent. Being ruled by co-nationals may appear to be breached somewhat in a federation when the federal government involves joint rule by the representatives of more than one nation. But providing the relevant nations have in some sense assented to this arrangement, no fundamental denial of the principle of national self-determination is involved. Moreover, if we acknowledge that dual or even multiple nationalities are possible, then federations, in principle, provide effective ways of giving these different identities opportunities for collective and free institutional expression. The purpose of these definitions is to permit federalism and nationalism to be compatible political philosophies. It's to avoid closing off empirical research on the relationship between nationalism and federation that I've defined matters in these ways. These definitions do not axiomatically deny the possibility of dual or multinational federations. And of course, they avoid any obvious commitments on the actual nature or status of nations. What about the ways in which nationalism and federalism have been historically treated? By and large, one can distinguish three perspectives. The first perspective is that nationalism and federalism are mutually exclusive. The exemplary illustration of this viewpoint is that of the French Jacobins, who believed that federalism was part of the counter-revolution, thoroughly hostile to the necessity of linguistic homogenization, which was believed essential to create a unitary and monistic form of popular sovereignty. In his report to the Committee of Public Safety of January 1794, Barrère declared, and I quote, that federalism and superstition speak Low Breton. Emigration and hatred of the Republic speak German. The counter-revolution speaks Italian, and fanaticism speaks Basque. Obviously, not a lot has changed in the last two centuries. On one reading of Ernest Gellner's work, the Jacobins were the nationalists par excellence. They sought cultural assimilation. They were determined to make peasants into Frenchmen, and therefore they were deeply hostile to all forms of accommodation that included this goal, including federalism. In partial agreement with the Jacobins, many 19th century federalists, notably Joseph Proudhon, were resolutely hostile to nation-state nationalism. And many 20th century federalists, notably in the European movement, reciprocate the Jacobin view that nationalism and federalism are mutually exclusive. Such federalists have been and are resolutely anti-nationalist, associating nationalism with ethnic exclusiveness, chauvinism, racism, and parochially particularistic sentiments. For them, federalism belongs to an entirely different cooperative philosophy, one that offers a non-nationalist logic of legitimacy and an antidote to nationalism rather than a close relative. This viewpoint was most clearly articulated by Pierre Trudeau, who was educated at the LSE by Ali Kadouri before he became the Canadian Prime Minister with certain predictable consequences. In an article entitled Federalism, Nationalism and Reason, Trudeau squarely associated federalism and functionalism with reason and nationalism with the emotions. Thinkers like Trudeau regard nationalism as the denial of, they regard federalism as the denial of and solution to nationalism, although occasionally they may adopt the view that federalism must build upon the success of nationalism, which it can then transcend in Hegelian fashion. In effect, thinkers of this ilk all agree with Einstein, who believed that nationalism is the measles of mankind. The second perspective, by contrast, holds that nationalism and federalism, properly understood, are synonymous. This was the thesis of the Austro-Marxists, particularly Karl Renner and Otto Bauer, in the last days of the Habsburg Empire. Lenin, Stalin, and their colleagues in the Soviet Union pressed the Austro-Marxist arguments into service in a suitably Baudrillardized fashion. In their conception, nationalism and federalism were to be harnessed, at least for the task of building Soviet socialism. In the words of Walker Connor, Lenin's second commandment on the management of nationalism was strategically Machiavellian. I quote, "Following the assumption of power, terminate the fact, if not necessarily the fiction, of a right to secession, and begin the lengthy process of assimilation via the dialectical route of territorial autonomy and federal autonomy for all compact national groups." Marxist-Leninists were, of course, formal cosmopolitans, committed to the development of a global order. But pending the World Revolution, they maintained that federal arrangements, national in form, socialist in content, were the optimal institutional path to global communism. The third perspective on the relations between nationalism and federalism is held by those who believe that these two philosophies are, in practice, compatible. But they sensibly believe that not all nationalisms are compatible with all federalisms. But this agreement masks an important difference between those whom I shall call mono-nationalists and those who are multi-ethnic or multinational federalists. Mono-national federalists or national federalists are exemplified by the very first exponents of federation, for whom its prime function was to unite people living in different political units who nevertheless shared a common language and culture. The people I'm thinking of in this case are the federalists who organized what eventually became the Netherlands, the people who organized the German-speaking Swiss lands, the people who organized what became the USA, and what became the Second German Reich. All of these federalists were national federalists. They maintained that only an autonomous federal government could perform certain necessary functions that confederations or alliances found difficult to perform, especially a unified defense and external relations policy. They often advocated federation simply as a stepping stone towards a more centralized unitary state. The United States may in fact serve as the paradigm case of national federalism. It's been imitated, of course, by its Latin American counterparts in Mexico, Brazil, Venezuela, and Argentina. The United States' federation shows little coincidence between ethnic groups and state boundaries, with one major exception. most of its original and subsequent states had white Anglo-Saxon Protestant majorities. Federation preceded the great expansion in the United States' internal ethnic diversity, and new states were generally only created when they had WASP, or assimilated white, demographic and electoral majorities. English-speaking whites were in fact the creators of every single American state, writing its constitution, establishing its laws, ignoring the previously settled American Indians, refusing to grant any rights of autonomy to blacks, and making only slight concessions to French and Spanish speakers in a few states. National federalism, in short, was part and parcel of American nation-building, aiding the homogenization of white settlers and immigrants in the famous melting pot of Anglo-conformity. This was even evident in the text of the Federalist Papers itself. National federalism, of course, poses no problems for Gellnerian theory. Indeed, it confirms it, because national federalists aim to make the sovereign polity congruent with one national public culture. Multinational or multi-ethnic federalists, by contrast, may seem to pose a significant challenge to Gellnerian theory, especially if they prove successful in their political endeavors. They advocate federation to unite people who seek the advantages of membership of a common political unit, but who nevertheless differ markedly in descent, in language, and in culture. They seek to express, to institutionalize, and protect at least two national or ethnic cultures, often on a permanent basis. Any greater union or homogenization, if envisaged at all, is postponed for the future perfect. They explicitly reject the strongly integrationist and or assimilationist objectives of national federalists. They believe that dual or multiple national identities are possible and indeed desirable. Some of them, in fact, make remarkable claims for federalism. Political scientist Klaus von Beimer, referring to Western democracies, argued in 1985 that Canada is the only country in which federalism did not prove capable of solving ethnic conflict. He was, of course, only referring to democracies. Multinational federalists have been influential in the development of federations in the former British Empire, notably in Canada, the Caribbean, Nigeria, South Africa, India, Pakistan, and Malaysia. They influenced Austro-Marxists and Marxist-Leninists and have had an enduring impact in the post-communist development of the Russian Federation, Ethiopia, and even arguably the rump Yugoslavia. The recent democratic reconstructions of Spain and Belgium also bear their imprint. The most ambitious multinational federalists of our own day are those who wish to develop the European Union from its current confederal status into an explicit federation, into a Europe of the nation states and a Europe of the citizens, in the words of the German foreign minister recently speaking at Berlin's Humboldt University. Multinational federalists have in fact two ways of arguing that national and ethnic conflict regulation can work to harmonize nationalism and federalism. The first is an argument from congruence. The argument here is that if the provincial borders of the components of the federation match the boundaries between the relevant national, ethnic, religious, or linguistic communities, that is to say, if there is a federal society congruent with the federating political institutions, then federation may indeed be an effective harmonizing device. That's precisely because it makes a heterogeneous political society more homogeneous through the creation of multiple homogeneous subunits. But of the seven large-scale genuine federations in durable Western democracies, only three significantly achieve this effect for some culturally distinct communities: the federations of Belgium, Canada, and Switzerland. The federations of Australia, Austria, Germany, and the United States do not achieve this effect, and indeed are not organized to do so. And in consequence, this possibility in federal engineering cannot be used to explain the relative ethno-national tranquility of Australia, post-war Austria and Germany, and indeed post-bellum United States. In all of these cases, past genocides, successful coercive assimilation, and indeed or integration and the overwhelming of indigenous populations are obviously the key variables. In Belgium, Canada and Switzerland, the success of federation in conflict regulation, such as it has been, has not been the result of deliberate comprehensive territorial design. Rather, it has largely been based upon historic geographical segregation of the relevant communities and accident. Post-independence India, especially after Nehru conceded the reorganization of boundaries around linguistic lines, has looked more like deliberate democratic engineering to match certain ascriptive criteria with internal political boundaries. Post-communist Russia and Ethiopia may prove to be others. Now, plainly, this defense of federation as a way of managing nationalism, to each nation let there be a province given, cannot satisfy those communities that are so dispersed or small in numbers that they cannot control any federal units or provinces. For example, Quebec Anglophones, Flemish speakers in Wallonia, Francophones in Flanders, blacks in the United States, or small and scattered indigenous peoples in India, Australia, and North America. Indeed, one reason why federation proved insufficient as a conflict regulating device as Yugoslavia democratized was because there was insufficient geographical clustering of the relevant communities in relation to existing provincial borders. But federal engineering to achieve something approximating the formula, one nation, one province, does look, prima facie, like a challenge to the tacit Gellnerian notion that in modern times the equilibrium condition is one sovereign state, one culture, or one nation. But if we treat broadly the political unit in Gellner's definition to encompass regional or provincial units in a federation, then his theory can accommodate such arrangements, but at the significant concession of recognizing that such federal systems are compatible with dual and possibly multiple nationalities. There is a second and more subtle way in which multinational or ethno-national federalists may argue that federalism and nationalism can be harmonized. But it's rarely explicitly defended, precisely because it's really a strategy to defeat national self-determination. This particular strategy has been eloquently defended by Donald Horowitz. He suggests, in effect, that federations can and should be partly designed to prevent ethnic minorities from becoming local provincial majorities. His thinking, in effect, recommends weakening every nationalism. His thinking is that the precise territorial merits of federalism is that its boundary-drawing devices can be used to weaken every single community, to break the possibilities of local majoritarianism and the attendant risks of secession. Designing provincial borders, in his view, should therefore be executed on balance of power principles, proliferating where possible the points of power away from one focal center, encouraging inter-ethnic conflict and creating incentives for inter-ethnic cooperation, and indeed for alignments based away from ethnicity altogether. This logic is, of course, extremely interesting, but empirical support for Horowitz's argument so far seems confined to the rather unpromising case of Nigeria. In most existing federations, to redraw regional boundaries on Horowitz's principles would require the services of military dictators or one-party communist regimes. Most existing well-organized ethnic groups would profoundly resist any attempts to disorganize them by redrawing political boundaries. Think of, for example, what would happen if proposals were to emanate from Westminster to divide Scotland into two political units. Belgium may be perhaps one exception to my skepticism about this Horowitzian argument. The Brussels region created in the new federation is neither overtly Flemish or Wallonian, and perhaps its heterogeneity will stabilize inter-ethnic relations in Belgium, because without the existence of Brussels, Flanders will not secede, and there is, of course, presently little prospect of Brussels obliging Flanders. Multinational and multi-ethnic federations have, of course, been developed for a variety of reasons, not just as a means to harmonize nationalism and federalism. They've often evolved out of multi-ethnic colonies to bind together the coalition that opposed the imperial power. Think of the West Indies, think of Tanzania. They may have been promoted by the colonial power itself in an attempt to sustain a reformed imperial system. But subsequently, these efforts developed a dynamic of their own, as has been true in Canada, India, and indeed South Africa. A history of common colonial government or conquest government usually creates elites, soldiers, bureaucrats, and capitalists with an interest in sustaining the post-colonial territory in one political unit, as has sometimes been the case in Indonesia, which has recently been re-canvassed as a case for an authentic federation. Large federations, of course, are often sold on economic grounds. They promise a large single market, a single currency, economies of scale, reductions in transactions costs, and fiscal equalization. Such discourses are, in fact, the common currency of Euro-federalists. Federations can indeed also be advocated as geopolitically wise. They offer greater security and protection than small states. Indeed, William Riker argued that this particular imperative was, in his view, the cause of the formation of all federations. Lastly, federations can be advocated as necessary routes to superpower status, a foreground note in some of the enthusiasms of some Euro-federalists. But the fact that multinational or multi-ethnic federations may be overdetermined in their origins does not affect our central question. Can multinational federations successfully and stably reconcile nationalism and federalism in liberal democratic ways? At first glance, the answer to this question appears to be yes and no. There are federal successes and there are failures. Even some positive yes answers, however, would be enough to counteract the pessimism induced by Ernest Gellner's theory. But let me first take you on a Cook's tour of the failures, which pose no problem for Gellner's theory. Multinational or multi-ethnic federations have either broken down or have failed to remain democratic throughout the communist world and throughout the post-colonial world. The federations of Latin America are either national federalisms and or have yet to prove themselves to be durably democratic. The federations of the Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia broke down during or immediately after their respective democratizations. In the post-colonial world, multinational or multi-ethnic federations failed or failed to be successfully established in the Caribbean, notably in the West Indies Federation. Even the miniature federation of St. Kitts Nevis recently faced the prospect of secession by referendum by the smaller island of Nevis, 30,000 people. Multinational or multi-ethnic federations have failed in sub-Saharan Africa, in Francophone West and Equatorial Africa, in British East Africa, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanganyika, and in British Central Africa, Northern and Southern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland. Or they've failed to remain durably democratic, Nigeria and Tanzania, or have yet to be established as durably democratic federations, South Africa. The Mali and European federations in independent Africa have experienced breakups, while the Cameroons have experienced forced unitary status after a federal beginning. The Arab world now knows only one federation, the United Arab Emirates, and it doesn't score high on any of the indicators of democracy. In Asia, there has been obvious federative failure, for example, in Indochina, in Burma, in Pakistan, and of the Union of Malaya, followed by the secession of Singapore. Durably democratic federations have been rare. Consider only the history of Pakistan. So in short, new multinational federations appear to have a poor track record as conflict-regulating devices, even where they allow a degree of minority self-government. They've broken down or failed to be durably democratic. India stands out as the major exception in Asia. These failures in federation have had multiple causes, according to their analysts. In some cases, minorities were outnumbered at the federal level of government. Lee Kuan Yew's courting of the Malay Chinese helped break the Malaysian Federation. In both scenarios, where you've got either a minority which is unwelcome at the federal level of government or is outnumbered, this creates very strong incentives for secession. Breaks from federation, of course, can be met with ferocious responses from the center. The Nigerian and American federations were halted through millions of deaths. India, the most successful Asian multinational federation, has so far faced down through sheer coercion vigorous secessionist movements on its frontiers, especially in Kashmir and the Punjab. Indeed, the threat of secession in multinational or multi-ethnic federations is such that the late Eric Nordlinger excluded federalism from his list of recommended conflict-regulating practices. The new emergent principle in international law, which in effect says that if a federation breaks up, it can break up legitimately around its provincial borders, has in some people's eyes created a fresh incentive for making federalism an undesirable form of state integration. So, in short, the evidence doesn't look very good. And I would want to add two generalizing statements about the difficulties attached to these federations. The first is that the evidence on bi-ethnic or bi-regional or bi-national federal systems is damning. In 1982, Maurice Weil could find no successful, durably democratic, bi-ethnic federation. Since then, we've seen the breakup of Czechoslovakia. Whither the rump Yugoslavia? What's going to happen between Serbia and Montenegro? As I've said, St. Kitts Nevis looks as if it's on the verge of breakup. So these kinds of units, in particular, appear to be dramatically unstable. The second generalization I'd like to make is that these failures have occurred largely in poor countries, where most people would say the prospects of democratization were not good anyway. So if we resume this evidence, it suggests that India and the multinational democratic federations of the advanced industrial world, Canada, Belgium, and Switzerland, are the apparently anomalous successes that Gellnerian theory needs to be able to explain, or else to stand as overtly falsified. Okay, this is where I bring the rabbit out of the bag. The theory that I wish to advance and to explore is that a stable democratic majoritarian federation, national federal or multinational federal, must have a Staatsvolk, a national or ethnic people who are democratically, demographically, and in any other way, dominant. This is a theory which is consistent with liberal nationalism, with national federalism, and with Ernest Gellner's theory of nationalism. It is inconsistent with liberal cosmopolitan and radical multiculturalists' hopes, and with the more optimistic beliefs of some federalists, though, as I shall argue, it does not require us to become deeply despairing about the possibilities of constitutional engineering. Let me call the theory Dicey O'Leary theory, which is as nice a pun as one could generate in the circumstances. I first found this argument developed in the writings of Dicey after I'd developed the bulk of the essay. It was pointed out to me by Dr. Mads Quattrup. This was deeply disappointing to me because Dicey's political tastes are as far from mine as it's possible to imagine. But if the theory turns out to be wrong, at least I've got somebody I cheerfully hate whom I can blame. For the present, however, we can share responsibility for this argument. The theory states a necessary condition of stability in a liberal democratic majoritarian federation. Its logic rests on simple micro foundations. In liberal democratic systems, the population share of an ethno-national group can be taken as a reasonable proxy for its potential electoral power if its members were fully mobilized en bloc, admittedly a rare occurrence. The underlying idea here is simple. In a majoritarian federation, an ethno-national group with a decisive majority of the federal population has no reason to fear federation. It has the ability simply to dominate the rest of the federation through its numbers, or to be generous because it does not feel threatened. A Staatsvolk, a people who own the state and who could control it on their own through simple democratic numbers, is a prime candidate to lead a federation, whether the federation is a national federation or a multinational federation. The theory may also give us a clue as to why multiple unit federations appear at first glance to be more stable than binary federations. A Staatsvolk may be more willing to have its own national territory divided up into multiple regions, states, or provinces, knowing that it's not likely to be coerced by minority peoples at the federal level. The theory also implies that if there is no Staatsvolk, then majoritarian federalism of whatever internal territorial configuration will not be enough to sustain stability, a point to which I shall return in a moment. What I'll do now is to provide you with some data which appear to confirm the merits of the Dicey-O'Leary theory. What I list here are the 23 currently democratic federations in the world. When I collected the data, Pakistan was still a democracy, and the Comoros Islands was still a functioning federation. The Comoros Islands, for those of you who are interested, and I owe this to Catherine Aidney and the CIA yearbook, have had 18 coup d'etat attempts since their independence. But if we exclude those unfortunate examples, which in fact don't damage the theory, we have all of the current democratic federations in the world illustrated in that table. What I do in each case is to list the share of the federation's population that I have classified as belonging to the relevant or potential Staatsvolk. I've arranged the data in descending order of the proportionate size of the relevant Staatsvolk. If we take 50% as our initial threshold for the existence of a Staatsvolk, which is a very plausible threshold for democratic majoritarian assessment, then it looks as if the data suggests that all the federations which have been durably democratic for more than 30 years have, at first glance, a Staatsvolk, which is significantly over 50% of the relevant state's population. Australia, 95, Austria, 93, Germany, 93, India, 80, if its Staatsvolk is defined religiously as Hindu believers. The United States, 74%, Canada, 67%, if its Staatsvolk is considered to be Anglophones, Switzerland 64%, and Malaysia 62%. The African federations have not been durably democratic, but on this measure, the Comoros Islands and South Africa have reasonable prospects. If they fail, it won't be because they lack a Staatsvolk. By contrast, neither Ethiopia nor Nigeria have a Staatsvolk, so the theory suggests that they're not likely to survive long if they're run as majoritarian democratic federations. The Russian Federation may not prove durably democratic, so on the Dicey-O'Leary theory, it has the necessary condition for survival. As for the other Asian cases, the table suggests that Pakistan should be on the threshold of crisis, thank you, and that India would be too if an attempt were made to construct a Staatsvolk out of Hindi speakers. Of Micronesia, I cannot speak because I am wholly ignorant. Likewise, I have little confidence in interpreting the Latin American data, but my colleagues assure me that they appear to suggest that Mexico and Brazil are closer to the threshold of the necessary condition than might be expected. And of course, their status as durable democracies is far from confirmed. The data in Table 1 even suggest that Switzerland and Belgium each have a Staatsvolk, doubtless something that would cause eyebrows to be raised in Zurich and Brussels. Now, you might say that this attempt to test for the existence of a Staatsvolk is very crude. And of course, you might want to argue that the data set is very small, n is 23. But it is exhaustive of all contemporary current democratic federations. So I believe, at least I can argue, that it's suggestive. There are no immediately anomalous cases. The federations without a Staatsvolk are of recent vintage and are not obviously democratically stable. The data, in short, appear to confirm Gellnerian theory on the political impact of nationalism. Naturally, of course, the data cannot prove causation. The stability of the durably democratic federations may have other causes, possibly mutually independent causes in each case, but it is, as I insist, suggestive. You might, of course, want me to be more sophisticated. How exactly should we determine whether a group is a candidate for the title of Staatsvolk? Perhaps we should focus more on the durably democratic and formally multinational or multi-ethnic federations that might be considered to constitute the strongest challenges to Gellnerian theory: India, Canada, Switzerland, and Belgium. If the primary division in India is linguistic rather than religious, then India might appear to lack a Staatsvolk. If Anglophones are considered too heterogeneous a category, it might be suggested that Canada's real Staatsvolk is those of British and Irish descent. One of the remarkable features of going to Canada is to discover as an Irishman that you get called British over there. It's also the case that if we look at the Swiss as divided by religion rather than language, it might appear to be the case that Helvetica appears to lack a definite Staatsvolk. And the sheer size of the Francophone minority in Belgium and the country's long traditions of dualism might lead us to pause before deciding that Belgium does have a Staatsvolk. How might we tackle these particular difficulties? One thing we might do is to develop an index which gives us some idea of the relative weight of the different groups in a federal system. So let me rephrase the Dicey-O'Leary theory, and I'll do it in this way. It's a very terrible mouthful, but I'll try and explain it in a moment. In a stable democratic majoritarian federation, the politically effective number of cultural groups must be less than 2 on the index of the effective number of ethnic groups, which is defined as the reciprocal of the Herfindahl-Hirschman concentration index of ethno-national groups. Very easy. Let me explain what that means. If you're a specialist in the field of electoral analysis and party systems, you can go to sleep for the next 2 or 3 minutes. This is a device used to determine whether or not we have a dominant party in a party system. Let me illustrate through a particular example. How might we respond to the question, how many groups are there in Belgium? One would expect to be told there are 2 big groups, Flemings and Walloons, with a smaller number of other groups, notably Germans and recent migrants. But does that mean that for politically important purposes that bear on the stability of the state, that Belgium has 2, 2 and an eighth, or 2 and a 16th ethno-national groups? The Herfindahl-Hirschman concentration index, which sounds like some kind of exotic ice cream, was designed to provide an objective way of measuring the effective number of components in a system. It does so in a way that stops us simply following our brute prejudices. The index runs from 0 to 1. Applied to groups, it has the following logic. In a perfectly homogeneous nation state, then the index will give us a reading of 1. Everybody belongs to the same group. If the state is extremely polyethnic in character, in which every family has broken up into a warring set of individuals who each claim to belong to an ethno-national group, then the index tends towards 0. The measurement method allows each group to determine its own weight. So in effect, what we do is find out the share of a group and multiply it by its own share. So let me illustrate how this operates in the case of Belgium. Flemings consist of 59% of the population. Multiply 0.59 by 0.59, we get 0.348. The Walloons consist of 39.3% of the population, so their weighted share is 0.153. Germans consist of a small fraction of the population. Multiplied by itself, it becomes an even smaller fraction, which corresponds with the intuitions of all but the most ardent Belgian Germanophiles. Now, the 3 numbers totaled together come to 0.501. So this is a way of showing that small groups shouldn't count too much in measuring the effective number of groups in a given system. The result of adding up all of these particular numbers gives us the Herfindahl-Hirschman concentration index, where, according to the index, P measures the fractional share of each particular group, and sigma here stands for summation over all components. Now, the reciprocal is simply that number divided into 1, and that gives us the effective number of ethno-national groups. Now, in Belgium, as I told you, the total was 0.501. 1 divided by 0.501 is as near as, damn it, to 2, which is, roughly speaking, what our intuitions told us. Now, of course, this example was chosen to be easy to understand. At least I hope it was easy to understand. Applied to all of the federations, I come up with a way of measuring the effective number of ethno-national groups in each particular country. The advantage of the index is, in effect, it allows us to think about the relationship between the dominant group and the other groups. So in Table 2, I provide data for all of the previously illustrated federations. But what I do is I add, in addition, their scores on the Herfindahl-Hirschman concentration index and the effective number of ethno-national groups index. I keep the same order of presentation, and as is readily apparent, there is a close relationship between the size of the Staatsvolk and the 2 scores, as there should be. But the relationship, of course, is not exact. You should notice that all the federations with effective number of ethnic group scores of less than 1.9 are in fact majoritarian federations, with the possible exception of India. By contrast, the bulk of the federations with effective number of ethnic group scores of 1.9 and above have often been classified as non-majoritarian federations because they normally have additional non-federal power sharing or, as it's sometimes said, consociational features. Or else they've had such institutions recommended to stabilize them. So here is where I bring political science to the rescue of Gellner's sociological pessimism. Consociational arrangements, clarified and theorized by Arendt Leipart, involve four features. First of all, cross-community executive power sharing. Secondly, proportional representation of all groups throughout the public sector. Thirdly, ethnic autonomy for those things that are of importance to ethnic groups, normally their own language and religion. And lastly, veto powers. If we look at all of the durably democratic multinational federations previously identified as problematic for Gellnerian theory, namely Canada, Switzerland, Belgium, and India, all of these have group scores of 1.9 or more. But the first three of these have relatively undisputed consociational histories. And Leipart has in fact recently claimed, I believe correctly, that India had effective consociational traits during its most stable period under Nehru. All this suggests that the theory, the Dicey-O'Leary theory, has a corollary. Where there is no Staatsvolk, or where the Staatsvolk position is precarious because it's below 50%, then a stable federation requires at least some consociational rather than majoritarian institutions if it is to survive, though of course its survival is by no means guaranteed. The micro-foundations of this theory are straightforward. Where no group has a clear majority, a balance of power among ethno-national groups is likely to exist. And such a balance of power is conducive to consociational arrangements, though of course it's also equally conducive to warfare and to secessionism. The corollary to the theory that I've developed here has very strong predictive and prescriptive power. Malaysia, South Africa, with autonomous Zulu organization, Pakistan, India with regard to its linguistic cleavages, Ethiopia and Nigeria may not endure as democratic federations unless they adopt consociational devices. In India, consociational add-ons have been most apparent in the development of ethnic autonomy in culture, the granting of provincial or Ländervolk status to major non-Hindi speaking peoples. If the arguments that I have developed here are correct, then the theory that I've developed is so far unfalsified. A majoritarian democratic federation requires a Staatsvolk, a demographically, electorally, and culturally dominant nation. This lends weight to Ernest Gellner's theory about the power of nationalism. But the corollary, the absence or near absence of a Staatsvolk, does not preclude democratic federation, but requires some consociational practices if it is to survive, suggests that we're entitled to have greater optimism about constitutional engineering than Ernest Gellner allowed us. Perhaps I should emphasize, in case I misunderstood, that federations can, of course, be destabilized for other reasons than the lack of a Staatsvolk, and that multinational federations may be destabilized for reasons that have nothing to do with the absence of consociational practices. What the theory and its corollary state are necessary conditions for stability in democratic federations. There may be other necessary conditions, but I haven't explored them here. Now, what happens if I'm right politically? Do my arguments have any practical political implications? I want to suggest they have implications for two units that most people here will be interested in. One is the United Kingdom, and the other is the European Union. The first argument is very simple. Those who want to federalize the United Kingdom have nothing to fear. The UK has a Staatsvolk, the English. The argument sometimes used that England is too big is in fact a wrong argument. It's precisely because England is so big that the United Kingdom could easily have a federation. The arguments are perhaps more interesting, however, for the European Union, particularly for those Euro-federalists who want to convert the European Union from a confederation into a federation. The European Union lacks a Staatsvolk. Its largest ethno-national people, the Germans of Germany, compose just over a fifth of its current population, about the same proportionate share as the Yoruba and Hausa have each in Nigeria. The European Union's effective number of ethno-national groups score is presently 7.23, higher than Nigeria's 6.69, and it will very soon go higher on the accession of the Poles, the Hungarians, and indeed Ernest Gellner's beloved Czechs. On the Dicey-O'Leary theory, to put it bluntly and insensitively, there are just not enough Germans for the European Union to function effectively as a majoritarian federation. This would still be true even if we, causing mutual outrage, were to treat Austrian, Dutch, and Swedish people as honorary Germans. The theory suggests by implication that calls to have a fully fledged European federation, with the classic bicameral arrangements of the United States, to address the so-called democratic deficit in the European Union, may be a recipe for institutional disaster, unless such calls are accompanied by strong commitments to consociational governance devices. Consociational governance implies strong mechanisms to ensure the inclusive and effective representation of all the nationalities of the European Union in its core executive institutions. Proportionate representation of its nationalities in public bureaucracies and legal institutions, national autonomy in all cultural matters deemed of profound cultural significance, language, religion, and education, and lastly but not least, national vetoes to protect national communities from being outvoted through majoritarian devices. In short, many of the current consociational and confederal features of the European Union, which some federalists want to weaken or temper in their pursuit of a formal federation, are, in fact, on this theory, required to ensure the European Union's prospects of surviving as a multinational democratic federation. This is not a Europhobic or Eurosceptical argument. The European Union has been correctly defended as a forum that has resolved ethno-national disputes between Germany and France, that has facilitated the resolution of conflicts between Austrians and Italians, and hopefully between British and Irish, that is a means through which various of the smaller ethno-national communities of Europe can enjoy opportunities for cross-border relationships. All of this is true, and I don't wish to deny it for one moment. I don't want to exaggerate the European Union's therapeutic powers, but I do want to suggest, on the basis of this theory, that one of the European Union's greatest dangers may come from its ardent majoritarian federalists. That is a conclusion with which I think Ernest Gellner should have been comfortable. Thank you.
Brendan, thank you very much for a most eloquent and interesting analysis. Brendan has kindly agreed to take a few questions before the reception, so if you'd like to, do you want to stand up here?
Sure, I'll stand.
Right.
Professor O'Leary, if Derek Trimble fails to persuade the Ulster Unionist Council to accept the word of the IRA in the current situation in Northern Ireland, how do you see the situation developing?
I think that's a very interesting question, but it has no relevance to the lecture I've just given. I would rather answer questions directly pertinent to the lecture I've just given. I took a vow that I wouldn't talk about Ireland during this particular lecture. For those of you interested, the theory suggests that an Irish federation could work.
Well, okay. Hello?
As you look at the 23 or so current federations that you looked at, particularly the U.S., have you projected through demographics any changes in the stability of those, particularly the U.S., given sort of projections of demographic change?
That's a very good question. I'm currently trying to collect data through time in two different ways. One, to look at changes in the distribution of ethnic groups within federations over time, and secondly, to look at changes in the nature of political units over time. If the theory is strongly causal, then we should be able to derive fairly robust conclusions to the effect that as a state becomes more heterogeneous, if it doesn't adopt consociational practices, then the federation will be in serious trouble. So in short, the implication for the United States is if it does become genuinely much more heterogeneous, if the white speaking assimilated European group becomes a smaller proportion of the population, and the U.S. does not adopt more consociational practices, in particular with respect to the Spanish-speaking peoples and the other ethnic minorities in the United States, then there should be greater instability in the U.S. That would be a logical derivation from the theory.
Yeah, you've looked at this, the stats folk at the state level,
But I just wonder, problems of cessation occur in regional units where you have a concentration of ethnic minorities. So even if you had a Staatsvolk, you could still have a demographic spread in such a way that you'd have a concentration of an ethnic minority in one area or several areas, and intuitively you would expect that to lead to problems. So is it just the existence of a Staatsvolk, or is it anything to do with the dispersion of the Staatsvolk throughout the territory? Or your theory doesn't really take account of the nature of the demography itself.
It's a good question. The theory states a necessary condition, and I was very surprised to discover how effective it was. I didn't have to introduce anything else. Remember, of course, that stating that it's a necessary condition doesn't mean it's a sufficient condition. The fact that there might be a Staatsvolk does not mean that you might not find secessionist pressures existing in some parts of the federal system. And you may well find secessionist attempts despite the existence of a Staatsvolk. What the theory really does is to focus on the motivations of the dominant people. Why should they put up with the burdens of federalism? And one crude answer is because it doesn't matter to them, it poses no threat to them. Or alternatively, they are generous because they are not threatened. So the theory is not focusing on the motivations of the minority or smaller peoples, but focusing primarily upon the motivations of the largest group. But the theory does have application at the regional level. One of the interesting questions is, if we go down within larger federations like Russia and indeed India, it might be the case that the theory might also be valid at the regional or provincial level. Namely, if there is a local Staatsvolk, then you would predict greater degrees of stability. That, of course, would be entirely contrary to the logic articulated by Donald Horowitz. But I haven't done the work for it. Catherine Aidney is doing work in this area on India, but I haven't seen the full results of it, so I can't say anything confident about it.
Also, can I just ask you a question about the nifty footwork on South Africa, which I'm afraid I noticed, which is that sort of blacks from, and one figure from, normally would be 77% of the population, you'd reduce them by dividing the Zulu people into half and taking away half the Zulu component, and then South Africa, instead of being below two, comes up to needing consociationism because of Mr. Buthelezi's activities. I mean, is this like kind of deciding that the sort of Cornish aren't really English, but might be a bit English, and take half of them away but not the full group to calculate the Staatsvolk?
It's an example of my broad-minded tolerance. I'm willing to interpret the South African data in either of two ways. Either to treat blacks in South Africa as a relatively homogeneous group, or alternatively to accept the arguments of Zulus that they are a separate people and differentiated from the rest of the South African population. It's plain, however, on electoral behavior that the Zulu population is roughly and crudely split 50-50 on urban-rural lines, and that urban Zulus, by and large, identify with the broader South African population. Rural Zulus do have clearly ethno-national sentiments of a distinctive kind. So basically, I ran the data with two possibilities, either counting all Zulus as black, or counting half of Zulus as part of the black group. And obviously, where the blacks are larger, incorporating all Zulus, South Africa can survive as a majoritarian federation comfortably. But if the Zulu population is split in the way suggested, it brings South Africa closer to the threshold of requiring consociational devices, which neatly corresponds with the advice you and I might give about how to manage KwaZulu-Natal.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
Over here. Thank you. Tamara has come to wait for a machine is coming. Here first, I think, and then the general. Come back to you in a moment.
Perhaps in anticipation of the next ASEAN conference, which is on nationalism and territory, what about the fact that you might have a majority, a Staatsvolk, sitting on a territory that does not have the diamonds or the gold or the natural resources? on which the minority live, and how do you deal with that?
Well, I want to stress again that the theory is not intended to explain when secessions occur. It's not intended. Sorry? You may not want secession. Many peoples of the world do. Some of them have good cases, some of them. President Clinton may. Well, his preferences are soon to be unimportant. The argument that I have advanced does not have strong and immediately strong implications for all forms of secessionist movements. It does suggest that where the dominant group is weaker, if it doesn't adopt consociational practices, it's highly likely to experience the breakup of the federal system. But that breakup could take different directions. It could take the form of territorial breakup. It could, by contrast, take the form of a centralized dictatorship imposing a much stronger union on the whole of the territory. So I think it's important not to overinterpret what you've just heard. It's confined to demonstrating, at least empirically, that certain of Gellner's propositions appear to be correct, and identifying necessary stability properties for federal systems. I don't think I can go beyond the evidence and the argumentation I've made.
Sorry, the gentleman over there.
Yes, thank you. Could you please comment on the prospects of for a federal solution in the case of Cyprus in terms of your theory?
Cyprus has a Stadtwald, but because it has a necessary condition doesn't mean that the sufficient conditions can be reached. The theory says nothing about the importance of external powers. Plainly, if Cyprus existed in a vacuum without the existence of Turkey and Greece, I think it's conceivable that you could have a federal system established successfully in Cyprus. But I think without a successful resolution of Turkish-Greek relationships, then it's very likely that the existing partition of the island is going to be sustained, and that the most that's likely to be accomplished in the short term is some effective confederal agreement, a confederation that will have very strong incentives for Turkish Cypriots if that confederation as a whole is given access to the European Union in some format. But for the present, I don't think the prospects of a Cypriot federation are strong. But it's not because Cyprus lacks the condition that's present in my theory. Cyprus meets the necessary condition, but the necessary condition on its own is not sufficient.
Over here, then first, and then the lady over there. Yeah. We'll just take a few more questions. Is it right with you?
Sure.
Professor Larry, my question is regarding what you say about the greatest risk that is facing the European Union. Do you think it's because of its insistence in make unity from diversity, or can you explain a little more what did you say?
It's union
of its insistence in on making unity from diversity, or can you explain a little more?
Okay. Well, I don't want to caricature those who argue about the democratic deficit in the European Union. But you hear regularly the argument that what we require as a solution to the problems of the European Union is a much more powerful European Parliament. And secondly, what's required is more efficient decision-making, by which is implied greater majority decision-making and a reduced capacity for national vetoes. Now, those are plainly arguments associated with majoritarian federal thinking. Now, the logic of my argument is to suggest that the stability of the European Union, given its multinationality, given the absence of a Stadtwald, is highly dependent upon its existing consociational and confederal practices. And if these were to be prematurely removed in a burst of new European institution building, we might endanger the achievements that we've already accomplished. I don't want to be misinterpreted. I don't want to say that I'm against the European Union or that I see everything in the existing European Union as desirable. Nobody could sit here comfortably and welcome the European Common Agricultural Policy, which does heavily depend upon the existence of certain national vetoes at present. Nevertheless, it's my view that any further steps in transforming the European Union, if they make it more majoritarian, could endanger its existing stability. That would be the message that I'd like to communicate.
Yes, over here, the gentleman over there. Thanks.
In the case of Brazil, your figures say that 54% are whites. But according to the latest census, the largest ethnic group are the blacks with 44%. What does indicate is that most people of the mestizo group try to identify the whites. That's why, because of racism, the whites are supposed to be 54%. If you go there, you'll see it's not like that. So can this work, according to your theory, a federation based on a stats folk in which many people are not really members of this group and just pretend to be?
Sure. Well, obviously, the census data in all of these cases has to be treated with some degree of appropriate suspicion. And I cannot claim to be a Brazilian expert. But as I understand it, the position in Brazil is such that, by and large, the larger groups, whites, mestizos, and blacks, aren't territorially concentrated in such a way that one could easily see a Brazilian federation built around a linkage between ethnicity and territory. There's sufficient dispersal and indeed sufficient integration of all the various groups and sufficient intermarriage between all three categories to suggest that Brazil is primarily a national federalism rather than a multinational federalism. Again, all my data show is that, very simply, that Brazil meets the necessary condition for stability. It doesn't say anything about whether it has the sufficient conditions. What's interesting is that the data appear to imply that because the Staatsvolk is so close to the 50% threshold, that Brazilian federalism might be more wholly stabilized if it adopted consociational devices to ensure the representation of all the major groupings in political parties, senior executive decision-making, the bureaucracy, the judiciary, and possibly to give them some forms of veto rights. But that's all that one could draw from what I've said tonight.
Any other questions? Oh, sorry, I have an eyes.
You focus your argument on federalist systems, but I wonder if anyone could draw any conclusions on unitary systems. I mean, what happens with stability when you have a unitary system? And the example here could be France, but I can't think of any multicultural unitary systems. I wonder if you could draw any conclusions. I mean, if it's a unitary system, is it more unstable or less unstable?
Well, some people say we live in a multicultural unitary state, the United Kingdom. I haven't explored the relationship between these indices and unitary states. I'd like to do that in the future, so my correct social scientific answer to you is wait for future research. The reason why I'm particularly interested in focusing on federations is because they appear to pose, at least at first glance, problems for those theories, such as Gellner's, which emphasize the power of nationalism in insisting upon one culture, one state. Most unitary states don't experience that kind of problem. And of course, where they do have minorities who are opposed to the existing state order, they may take wholly coercive responses, occasionally accommodative ones.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much, Professor O'Leary, for a really fascinating and original analysis, which expands and takes forward Ernest Gellner's original theory and tests it in the political sphere. I think it very well worthwhile evening, and thank you very much again. And you are invited to a reception in the senior dining room, senior common room, on the fifth floor upstairs. Thank you all very much for coming.